This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Home prices are on the rise.
You heard right. Home prices are on the rise.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, June 28th.
And before we get any questions, Steve, I saw somebody wrote in and said, is this really the Marketplace Morning Report or the Midday Update? Well, it's both, sort of.
Yeah.
It's all of the Marketplace Morning Report put together in the Midday Update. Coming up, we'll get the latest news, good news, you might say, when it comes to the housing market.
Also, which world metro area contributes the most to the global economy? Is it New York, Jeremy? Is it London, Tokyo, Shanghai?
We shall find out. Mm. And you'd think shoplifting would go up when the economy goes down, but in fact, it's just the opposite.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Let's start with the housing market today. Home prices are up for the first time in 8 months. Boy, we haven't said that in a while.
Yeah.
According to the S&P Case-Shiller Index that was out this morning, prices are rising in 13 of 20 cities, including Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and Atlanta.
On the flip side, six metro areas are still falling and have fallen to their lowest levels in years. Those are Chicago, Charlotte, Detroit, Las Vegas, Miami, and Tampa. For more, let's turn to our regular Tuesday analyst, Julie Niemann from Smith, Moore & Company. She joins us from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, Julie, what do you make of these numbers?
Well, it's actually very good news simply because we're grasping at straws here. You know, a slight increase the first time in 8 months, and it's slightly better than expected. But note of my repeat use of the word slight here. So we're really struggling to get any kind of good news. But bottom line is, this is all done without that $8,000 tax credit. So this is actual real purchasing going on here, not kicking the can down the road.
And what's leading to that, Julie? What are people doing that all of a sudden is creating a thirst for new homes?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, there are new job opportunities out there, and they're typically in another city. People couldn't move there before because they couldn't get rid of their old house. So it's showing that there are some opportunities over there. Also, you're seeing people moving up to bigger houses, and this has always been the semi-American dream, is you start with your starter house and then move up to something bigger. So we're seeing a little bit of movement there. And bottom line, school is out, so now you can move as well. So it's seasonal.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up because, we've had so many fits and starts in the housing market. I want to ask, is there anything about the fact that this is the spring selling season? Maybe these numbers are skewed in a way.
Well, it does distort it a little bit simply because of the school being out here. And we did have this kind of rally in housing last year, and then the whole thing fizzled. But this time it's looking a little bit more positive simply because some of the headwinds in the economy are actually getting a little easier. Energy, severe storms, food, these things are easing up somewhat. So maybe we're looking at a bottoming out in the process now. Not so negative news.
Some slight optimism from Julie Niemann, analyst at Smith, Moore & Company. Thanks, Julie.
You bet.
Well, some tough budget news coming out of states this week. Minnesota may be facing a shutdown. Washington is slashing its state tourism office. Now New Jersey has come up with a way to find some extra cash as well. But they're going to a bank and asking for a loan. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is with us from Washington with the latest on that story. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning, Steve.
So what exactly is the Garden State doing?
Well, it's negotiating a line of credit called a bridge loan, reportedly with J.P. Morgan. The state is asking for up to $2.25 billion. New Jersey officials shook the spare change out of the couch cushion, Steve, but the state is still scrounging around for money. Banks do see the state as a good risk. It's going to have tax money coming in. It just didn't take in enough this year. I talked to Nick Johnson about this. He's at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He says the state's budget negotiators should have considered closing tax loopholes or even raising taxes.
You know, if the two sides sat down and put everything on the table, including considering some not just deep spending cuts, but also revenue things, they probably wouldn't have to go to the banks. My understanding is that the governor's largely taken the whole revenue side of the budget off the table.
What about other states, Nancy? How are they handling their budget challenges?
Well, New Jersey's approach is unusual. States normally borrow money by issuing bonds, but that's a pretty complicated process. It can take a few months. Bank loans are quicker. They take less documentation. Of course, the downside is the bank loans are more expensive. The interest rates can be pretty high.
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reporting from Washington. Nancy, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, the biggest state in the country is also dealing with a budget crisis, and it has just reached a deal. That would be California, and the deal involves cutting spending, but also using very rosy revenue forecasts in order to make up for a $10 billion budget gap. Let's get some analysis on that now from Tracy Gordon, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution and an expert on state budgets. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what do you make of California's solution?
Well, states are really facing a difficult situation. They've had a couple of years where they were really walloped by the recession and revenues were way down. They're just starting to come out of that, but they have a big hole to come out of. Voters are pretty resistant to tax increases, and Governor Brown's been pretty unsuccessful in getting Republicans to agree to even put them on the ballot. So, you know, they're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place and forced to rely on what some people might call gimmicks or one-shot solutions.
Are gimmicks just a way of pushing the problem down the road?
That's right. And fortunately, there's actually a group coming together right now. Former Lieutenant Governor Ravitch in New York and Paul Volcker are starting to look at some of the long-term liabilities of states and put more focus on those issues. And I'm hoping that, you know, that will help educate voters and legislators and governors alike, and we can have a conversation about, you know, some of these long-term liabilities, some of the long-term costs of these policies.
Tracy Gordon, visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, now to a high-stakes hearing that the Food and Drug Administration is holding today. It's about whether the drug company Roche can continue to market its drug Avastin to treat breast cancer. The company got preliminary approval a few years ago, but last December, the FDA considered undoing that.
Well, today, Roche will make its case in the first challenge to the FDA's conditional approval process. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
The so-called accelerated approval program at the FDA first came out of the debate over access to experimental drugs for HIV/AIDS. The idea was the agency should move quickly to grant approval for drugs where lives were at stake, even before all the evidence was in.
The whole point of a provisional approval is that it can be rolled back if it turns out that the drug does not perform as first expected.
Karuna Jagger of the advocacy group Breast Cancer Action says the FDA did just that. It provisionally approved the drug Avastin for late-stage breast cancer in 2008, but the agency rolled it back when later tests showed that the drug did not increase overall survival and had potentially fatal side effects. Roche makes $1 billion a year from Avastin's use in breast cancer. It appealed the FDA decision. Harvard professor Daniel Carpenter says all that political pressure has many scientists worried.
People are worried that once you grant provisional approval, it's increasingly difficult, if not impossible, to reverse.
He says that if the FDA loses this fight, it may make it harder for future drugs to get accelerated approval in the first place. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
This morning, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner endorsed France's Christine Lagarde to lead the International Monetary Fund. That essentially ensures her appointment in a vote that could come as soon as today.
You can find more business and economic news at marketplace.org. We are also on Facebook at APM Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. Tens of thousands of Greek workers are off the job. They're striking today. The protests once again getting violent. Police have once again fired tear gas into the crowds. And the crowds are mad about big pension and benefit cuts being proposed to get more European help. Greek troubles, of course, are rippling through the global economy, and we continue our look at how things could go from bad to worse in other countries because of those Greek problems. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford has more from Madrid.
For a long time, investors have lumped Spain alongside Greece as one of the weaker European economies to watch out for. For one thing, its unemployment rate is over 20%. The government spent the past year trying to prove it's not on the brink, passing deeply unpopular wage and budget cuts. Last month, tens of thousands of young Spaniards camped out on the streets in protest, and the government lost heavily in local elections. Spain's prime minister has promised the cuts are over. But if Greece does default, that could be a hard promise to keep. Ismael Sanz is professor of economics at Madrid's Rey Juan Carlos University. He says, unlike Greece, Spain could be too big for Europe to bail out.
This would mean a big impact on the European economy. The European Union will try to do everything they can to avoid having to give Spain a bailout, because I don't know if the euro will survive this.
But Professor Sanz says if Greece does survive this crisis, Spain would get some breathing space, time to get its own economy back on track, time too to start creating more jobs for young Spaniards. In Madrid, I'm the BBC's Sarah Rainsford for Marketplace.
While striking public workers continue their protests in the streets, at Greek seaports, more than 350 pro-Palestinian activists are sending a flotilla of boats to Gaza in defiance of Israel's trade blockade of the territory. And Palestinians also hope a new Egyptian government will allow goods to pass through its border crossing with Gaza. Reese Ehrlich has more from Gaza City.
The fields near Ahmad Shafi's farm are sometimes used by Palestinian militants firing homemade rockets into Israel. As long as such attacks keep up, Israel says it will go on restricting imports and exports into Gaza. Shafi had hoped the recent opening of the border crossing into Egypt here at the Rafah Gate would soften the effects of the Israeli blockade. He was disappointed.
Economically, it doesn't mean much because only people, not commercial goods, can cross. Then again, opening Rafah Gate is a big help for Palestinians because it's an opening to the outside world.
But not everyone benefits from that opening. Abu Omar lowers a rope into a 50-foot deep tunnel entrance. He operates a tunnel that used to bring smuggled consumer goods from Egypt to Gaza.
We're only smuggling about 1 to 2 shipments a month. We used to transport every day. Now people bring their own goods across the Rafah Gate.
Many things are still scarce in Gaza, such as construction supplies, medical equipment, and drugs. Economy Minister Ala al-Rafati says restrictions make exporting tough, and they can't get raw materials for factories. Unemployment stands at 45%. Israel's blockade, he argues, hurts ordinary Gazans more than the Hamas government, which Israel labels a terrorist organization.
Because we can't export, unemployment increases along with the poverty rate. That makes people suffer.
Israeli officials argue that opening the Egyptian border to normal trade would encourage arms smuggling. So far, they've managed to pressure Egypt's government to prohibit such commerce. It seems likely that trade will be banned at least until a new Egyptian government takes power after elections in September. In Gaza City, I'm Reese Ehrlich for Marketplace.
Well, today, Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer will unveil Office 365. It's all those things Office is known for, word processing, email, the like. It may sound like a typical Microsoft software release, but in fact, it is a shot across the bow in its fight with Google over cloud computing. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Microsoft wants us to ditch our desktops and hard drives and do more computing online. And with 1 billion computers already running Microsoft Office, the message to computing rival Google is like that Stones song. Microsoft's pitch to business customers? Get on our cloud instead. For $6 a month per user, you can lose the headache of running servers, access your data and applications whenever you want. Jim Yin covers Microsoft at Standard & Poor's.
People are becoming more mobile. They don't necessarily have to be tied down to a single desktop, either at work or at home.
Google jumped on the cloud first, but that's never stopped Microsoft, says business consultant Gene Marks. Remember WordPerfect, Lotus, Netscape?
They let other people come up with the ideas. They wait until it attracts a market, and then they pounce.
But if they pounce too hard, they could crush their cash cow, sales of regular old Windows and Microsoft Office. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
A new study from IDC finds the world's information is doubling every 2 years. Steve, do you know what our count this year will be?
Oh, I can't even imagine.
1.8 zettabytes will
zettabytes.
Be created this year alone. Yes.
How many zeros is that?
I think it's 1,000 gigabytes.
Yeah.
But that can't be right.
No, a terabyte is.
Terabytes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Well, anyway, yeah. It's a lot. But if you want to know how much it actually is, this is an easy way to think about it. Imagine everybody in the United States sending 3 tweets every minute for 26,976 years.
All right. So if I do the math here, let's 26,000. We're 310 million American.
Exactly.
I think that comes out to 1.8 zettabytes.
Yeah, that's right. It's 1.8 zettabytes exactly. Well, we don't tweet that much, but we do tweet. I'm at Jeremy Hobson on Twitter.
And I'm at Radio Chio, and my brain is fried right now.
It's quiz time here at the Marketplace Morning Report, and we're going to talk global metro economies now with Stefan Richter, who is editor-in-chief at theglobalist.com and our quiz master this morning. Morning, Stefan.
Good morning, Jeremy. Are you ready for today's quiz?
I'm ready.
Okay, so here's my question. Which metro area around the world accounts for the greatest share of the global economy? Is it A, New York, B, London, C, Tokyo, or D, Shanghai?
I've got to go with New York. As a former New Yorker, I have to say it's got to be New York.
I know that you would have a home bias, and you're of course wrong. This was especially designed for you to let you fall into that trap. But at least on the good news front, I can tell you New York is close. It is number 2 in the world. It accounts for about 1/40 of global GDP. So one of every $40 earned around the world come from the New York metro area. So that's pretty impressive.
Okay. I guess I'll go then with Shanghai.
You're a futurist. You're a futurist. Shanghai may well get there. Based on data from the Brookings Institution from 2007 when they last did this, Shanghai ranked number 33. Of course, with Chinese growth, they're going to rise up the global league table fast. But here's one area where the Chinese at long last are not number 1 yet.
All right. Well, I know Tokyo has the biggest population, I think, of all of those cities. So maybe, is it Tokyo?
Of course it is. Bingo. Uh-huh. You're a brilliant man in the current news flow. It shows how important the events are with all the earthquakes, tsunamis, and so on. Tokyo, indeed, accounts for almost 3.5% of global GDP. That's one out of every $30 and a little bit more earned around the world. And Japan is very metro area strong. Osaka, the second largest economic center in Japan, is 4th worldwide. And, you know, far ahead of Seoul, for example, which is the only other Asian city in the global top 10, the Korean capital.
Wow. Well, there you go. Stefan Richter, editor-in-chief at theglobalist.com. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Nicely done, Jeremy, with your quiz. And finally, conventional wisdom tells us when the economy is in the dumps, people steal more stuff. So the National Retail Federation's new report showing shoplifting on the rise could be construed as bad news, right? I mean, people
that's
are stealing
more.
That's awful.
Yeah.
You know, it's no. As retail thinking goes, it is good news because a lot of the shoplifters are store employees.
Really?
Yeah. Here's the rationale. Employees are taking more chances to steal things because they don't fear for their jobs as much. They're not so worried about getting caught, because if they do get caught, they'll get, well,
things are better.
You would
than
think they would be prosecuted, but yeah. I mean, you know, but they can find another job someplace else.
That's right.
Yeah. So all hail this recovery, huh?
Is this keyboard still available?
Yeah.
All right.
In Los, need to take fingerprints before you leave.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles,
and I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.